This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. NASA's Commercial Crew program is set to make a giant leap this summer with the first astronauts to blast off from US soil since the end of the shuttle program in 2011. Before that, SpaceX, one of the two companies to land a commercial crew contract, is sending its spacecraft, the Crew Dragon, on a test run to the International Space Station. It's the culmination of years of testing and fine-tuning the spacecraft, and it signals the start of a new phase in the US space program, which for the last few years has relied on Russia to ferry astronauts into low Earth orbit. So what does this mean for the United States and for Florida? Do you have a personal connection to the space industry here in Florida, or perhaps you're excited to see a return to human launches from the Kennedy Space Center? What are your hopes for the era of commercial spaceflight? Do you have concerns about relying on private companies to get astronauts into orbit? We're talking space with our panel of space journalists and scientists, and we're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252, and you can tweet your comments and questions to WMFE Orlando. First, though, I talked to Space Florida's Dale Ketchum for some insight into what this weekend's test flight means for the commercial crew program and for NASA. Dale Ketchum is the Vice President of Government and External Relations with Space Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to do it.
Dale, we are poised, or SpaceX is poised, to launch the first privately built spacecraft designed to carry humans to the International Space Station. How big of a deal is this for the private space sector?
Well, it's certainly the culmination of a process that began in 2011 when President Obama had canceled Constellation program and chose to turn over getting low Earth access to the private sector. And that was considered controversial at the time, but I think the focus on turning over that to the commercial sector was the signature accomplishment of the Obama administration in the space field. So this is really kind of coming to fruition, and I think for the most part, everybody's excited about it, recognizes this is the right way to go. We've been getting into space for 50 years now, and that's something the government doesn't necessarily need to do because the private sector can execute quite well. And they can do it faster and cheaper, and we're going to see if that all works.
Is there anyone who isn't excited about it? Anyone who's saying, look, NASA should have really just kept complete control of this throughout, and the turning some of it over to the private industry is not the way to go?
There are certainly some components within the agency that have always felt that NASA should maintain control over anything that has to do with humans in space. For the most part, I think those concerns have been overcome. There are still issues to be resolved. But the private sector, you know, in many ways, having worked for the private sector myself with Rockwell on the shuttle, NASA had a great deal of oversight. But if you ask the contractors, they would tell you that they were the ones fixing the problems and turning the wrenches and making the thing work. So we're going to see whether or not this thing continues to succeed as a private sector endeavor. But I believe it will. It's destined to.
I guess at the end of the day, those earlier vehicles that got astronauts into space from Florida or from U.S. soil, they were built by private companies anyway, right? It was just NASA had more of the overall direction for the program.
Well, NASA had previously always been responsible for the design and approval of every change. And, you know, that worked well, but that was very expensive. What we have now is NASA is overseeing what's being done and making sure that it meets their standards. But the actual design and progress, they're not necessarily setting requirements. They're just setting, this is what we need to have happen. And then the private sector stepping up and saying, we can meet that requirement.
So essentially they're just saying, look, we need to get to the International Space Station. You folks figure it out.
Correct. NASA still has a great deal of oversight in terms of production, quality control, things of that nature, making sure that there are appropriate redundancies and safeties in there. But the private sector is at liberty to design and build as they choose to meet those requirements. The design that Boeing has is different. It's still basically a capsule, but it looks a lot different than the one SpaceX has, which, again, is part of the process, part of the thinking all along about commercial crew was to enable the private sector to innovate and compete, and that will drive lower cost and more responsive technology.
It also, though, assumes that there's a bunch of different companies that are interested in this in the sector, right? And it's expensive. So really, how many private companies are interested, or, you know, once SpaceX and Boeing successfully start launching astronauts into space, how realistic do you think it is, Dale Ketchum, that there will be other companies knocking on the door of NASA saying, I want a part of this too?
That would be predicated entirely upon what is the demand. As it stands right now, the International Space Station is scheduled to be retired, either in 2025 or 2028 or 2030. That's still to be determined. It would take a private sector quite a bit of time to get into meeting that, being able to meet that demand. And at this point, you would not be able to recover your investment with enough work prior to that. Once there are other locations to go to, private sector space stations, the Chinese space station, which is due to be launched in a couple of years, when the demand is out there, that's one of the beauties of capitalism. When the demand is out there, the private sector will rise and provide the supply.
Do you think private companies like SpaceX, has there always been this assumption that there will be a space station, an international space station of some form or other, that there'll be this demand? Or has there always been some, like, a finite end point to the International Space Station? And I guess, of course, you know, this isn't the first space station there's been up in space, right? I mean, there was Skylab before that.
Skylab, and then the Soviet Mir space station. But, you know, you got to remember, there's millions of people born and walking on the planet right now who have never been alive when there wasn't somebody in space. And hopefully the point at which there are no people in space is behind us. We're just going to continue to get more and more and more people in space, all as a part of our collective efforts to become an interplanetary species to assure the survival of humanity in the long run. But I think this gets more to a simple function of capitalism. Is there a demand for a service? If there is a demand, somebody will find a way to supply that demand. And I think there is a lot of expectation and a lot of proposals now, both to NASA and internal within the private sector, to come up with either private sector platforms like Bob Bigelow is proposing. You know, he has a nodule on the space station right now that's proving his technology. And I think we can expect to see them up there pretty soon. He, coincidentally, is waiting on a supply of transportation to get, so that he knows people can get up to space, private sector people can get up to space, because he was ready to build a space station quite a few years ago with technology that's already proven, but the delay in getting commercial crew around caused him to completely postpone those efforts until some point in the future. But there will be new places to go in space, simply because it looks as though there is research and manufacturing and mining and tourism. Humans are a pretty creative bunch, and they're pretty curious, and a lot of them have a lot of money. So I think there's a reasonable degree of confidence that there is going to be a market in the future.
The International Space Station, though, I mean, it's kind of one of these symbols of, although there are many differences in, you know, how to get to space and even kind of political differences, it's a symbol of collaboration, right? Which is part of the reason it's such a big deal, having this floating outpost up in space that a lot of countries have a part in.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. It's the single biggest international engineering achievement in the history of our species. And it is, in many ways, it can be criticized for not accomplishing some of the things that it was originally laid out to do. But concurrently, it is doing, and I think history will reflect that it is doing the one thing that is most important, which is it is teaching us what we need to know to survive in space for long periods of time. How do things degrade? How do we repair them? How do humans respond to long duration lack of gravity? And how do we deal with it when we get back? lot of basic fundamental issues that the International Space Station is being able to provide us insight into that we will need in the centuries to come as we go out into space as an interplanetary species.
The end of the shuttle program, Dale Kitcham, left a pretty big hole in the economy on the Space Coast. How do you see commercial crew filling some of that gap or even extending it further?
Well, the key to the success of commercial crew is not so much that it's a huge job generator. It is not the standing army that we had during the shuttle program. And that's, in many ways, is what a part of what we caused the retirement of the space shuttle was, because it was so very expensive to operate, in large measure because it had a very large standing army required to operate it. And I say that with a great deal of love. At one time, I was part of that standing army. But the key to commercial space, and I think the intent behind it, is that it lowers the cost of getting into orbit so that ultimately the significant job generation is not in the transportation field. It's in the concurrent activity that results in cheaper access to space, whether it's manufacturing, mining, research, exploration, tourism, and making things more available, making the capability of doing things in space more available to more people. And that is, in large measure, I think, what's driving the renaissance we have here on the Space Coast and in East Central Florida more broadly, with Blue Origin, SpaceX, Northrop Grumman, OneWeb, now Firefly, and more to come, hopefully.
And I guess the next step, once this test launch is completed successfully, is to actually put some astronauts onto the SpaceX capsule and send them up into low Earth orbit, right?
That will be the big day. I think that's the one everybody's looking forward to. Hopefully it is not a 2:40 a.m. launch at that time.
Well, Dale Kitcham with Space Florida, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to do it. Thanks, Matthew.
We're taking your calls on Intersection. Where do you see the new era of commercial spaceflight taking the United States and Florida? Do you miss the glory days of the shuttle? The number is 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. And you can reach out to us on Twitter as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Joining us in the studio, the Orlando Sentinel's Chibeli Herrera, who covers the space industry for the Sentinel. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Laura Forsick with Astrolytical. She's a space policy analyst. Laura, welcome back to Intersection as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
And 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, thank you too.
Happy to be here.
And we're taking your questions and comments as well. The number 1-866-338-5252. What does NASA and the United States stand to gain from throwing open low Earth orbit to private companies? You're excited to see astronauts returning to orbit from the U.S. soil once again. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. Chibeli, I want to start with you. You were at that briefing yesterday. What can we expect from this launch?
Yeah, so this is going to be a really exciting launch. The teams at NASA, SpaceX, the International Space Station have been working closely together on this for some time. And if all goes well, this is going to clear the way for a crewed launch. So logistics-wise, you heard Dale say at 2:49 a.m., that's going to be a fun one for everyone. Mm-hmm. Docking in the ISS 27 hours later. It's going to spend 5 days on the International Space Station, and then it's going to re-enter the Earth and splash down in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida. So we can expect the teams are going to be looking very closely, monitoring how the capsule performs, how it docks with the ISS, how it re-enters the Earth, and how the mannequin inside responds to those conditions.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, launches, and especially night launches, are quite a bit different now, right, with SpaceX landing their boosters back on the remote-controlled ship at sea. So you see the kind of spectacular, the night sky light up, and then you see the boosters come down again. It's pretty spectacular to watch that.
Oh, absolutely. And last week we had a lunar lander launch, and the moon rose in the horizon just as the booster was coming down. So it looked like the rocket was landing on the moon from our perspective, which is very cool.
That is pretty cool. Well, if you're planning to watch that early morning launch tomorrow, we want to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. What does this signal for this new era of space transportation, space flight, That number again, 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Chabela, you mentioned the mannequin. Is this just for kind of publicity's sake, or is there some purpose to strapping a mannequin into the capsule?
So both, I think. The mannequin, her name is going to be Ripley. That's after Ellen Ripley from the Alien movies. So we know SpaceX likes to make those call outs. And she does have a purpose. So she's going to have some sensors. She's going to be wearing a SpaceX astronaut suit. She's going to have some sensors. They're going to measure forces, acceleration. And that data will be sent back to the team, and they'll be able to see how she experienced the flight, how a person might experience the flight. Although SpaceX did tell us yesterday they don't expect any surprises on this end, so they expect this to go smoothly. She's also going to have, on the sort of promotional side, there's going to be videos from inside the capsule. You're going to see what it looks like from her perspective. And so that should sort of harken back to last year when the Falcon Heavy sent up Starman, and mm-hmm. we got some really cool videos of him up in space. And so I think they're thinking of doing some of that again this time.
There was a soundtrack for Starman 2, David Bowie. Do we know what the soundtrack's going to be for this?
No, we don't know. It took us a while to get the name, so we're working. I'll ask about that today.
Mm-hmm. That was breaking news yesterday, the name of the mannequin.
That was the first question at the press conference. What's the name?
Mm-hmm. So it's working. I mean, if they're looking to generate some interest in this, then clearly they're going about it the right way.
Absolutely.
We're getting some calls already. Taking a call here from Doug. Doug, you're on the air. What does this launch mean to you?
Well, I'm very excited about it. I previously worked for Orbital and for McDonnell Douglas Space Systems. I do have a concern, though, that we're talking about these smaller launch vehicles, and while they're interesting, they're really not going to get us to the Moon or Mars. I think we really need to be focusing more on heavy lift launch vehicles like the SLS, something in the 100-ton payload category, something on the order of the shuttle or the Saturn V.
Just let me come back to that point you made just now, though. I mean, you've worked on some of the technology previously. Are you excited at least to see about the notion of astronauts being launched from U.S. soil again?
Certainly, I've been concerned for a long time because of our relationship with Russia being somewhat antagonistic over the last 10 years. That at any point we might get cut off from our access to the space station.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug, thank you so much for your call. Brendan, I wonder if I could throw that question to you about the idea of, sure, it's cool to be excited about low Earth orbit, but what about heavy lift? I mean, I know that SpaceX has some plans in the works there. What does this kind of fit into that somehow? The kind of ferrying astronauts to the International Space Station, does that fit into the bigger scheme of getting astronauts further out into space down the track?
Yeah, when you talk to NASA and you talk about their long-term plans, when you kind of, you know, zoom out to the 250,000-mile view, you can see that the whole plan was to have these commercial partners take over the ferrying of cargo to the International Space Station and then eventually ferrying of astronauts to the International Space Station so that NASA could focus its efforts on deep space exploration. Mm-hmm. Where that is, that changes every few years. It was Mars, it was an asteroid, now we're looking at the Moon. But the plan is to kind of take some of the heavy lifting of staffing the station and
I see what you did there.
You like that? Supplying the station so they can focus on, as the caller mentioned, the Space Launch System, which is the heavy lift vehicle.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. That's 1-866-338-5252. Perhaps you're a resident of the Space Coast and you're excited to see this nighttime launch. They are pretty spectacular. Maybe you're kind of interested in the bigger picture about what it means to have the United States launching astronauts once more once this test launch gets done and they actually strap some astronauts into the capsule. We'd like to hear from you. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Laura Forsick from Astrolytical, I want to bring you into the conversation. Talk us through a little bit about why NASA decided to throw things open to private companies and the path to getting to this point, because it's taken a while, you know, once the shuttle retired to be in the position where now we're just months away, it seems, from actually blasting astronauts back into space again from Florida.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. I'm glad our caller Doug brought it up. So back in the day when we were talking about retiring the shuttle and questioning what should replace it, that was the original motivator, was to turn the operations in low Earth orbit over to the private sector. You're seeing that in both transportation and payloads. And a lot of the payloads now are funded or built by or designed by the private sector. And you're also in the future hoping, NASA's hoping to eventually retire the International Space Station and turn either return that over to the private sector or to have the private sector take over with their own smaller space stations. Mm-hmm. And all of that is to help NASA to focus their efforts and their funds onto bigger things, the bigger things being the big heavy lift rocket, SLS, or deep space exploration, NASA's next gateway around the moon, the space station that they're hoping to build. And while that's happening, NASA has the ability right now to help the emerging space sector with building the infrastructure needed to create that kind of marketplace that we want to see out of low Earth orbit. So we want to have the private sector operating more than they currently are in low Earth orbit, as well as extending outward beyond Earth. Mm-hmm. And so NASA is doing both. They're both helping themselves by helping themselves get freeing up funds to focus on bigger things. And they're also helping the private sector to really take over those operations that we take for granted right now that NASA does.
Mm-hmm. Getting another call here. We've got Joe chiming in from Georgia. Joe, what's on your mind thinking about this upcoming launch this weekend?
Did you say Jeff or Joe?
I said Joe. Is it Joe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not in Georgia. I'm in Ormond Beach.
But, oh, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, it's okay. My question is about kind of the financial model, talking about private versus NASA controlled. My assumption is that under the old model, the contractors were paid to build the craft and run it, whereas under the new model, they're paid, you know, for results, to actually deliver people. Mm-hmm. So they have some risk. I just wonder if your guest could comment on that.
Yeah, that's a great question, Joe. Chibeli, what do you think of that, the sort of different model here, and how different is it from, you know, what we've seen in the past with NASA?
So with this launch and this contract, SpaceX was given $2.6 billion and Boeing $4.2 billion for the development of these capsules. And that's quite different from what we've seen. I think Laura would probably be able to tell you more detail on how that's changed since she's been following it much longer.
Mm-hmm. Laura, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it is quite different. We heard earlier from Dale Ketchum as well that you know, part of this is just to see how they can do it. They're obviously saying we can do this cheaper. We've got some parts that we can sort of reuse and recycle, so that's going to be a cheaper option for the government. Is there a bit of a wait and see here, do you think, with this new financial model?
I don't think it's a wait and see. I think it's already been proven. And there are different applications for this. So the big expensive NASA missions that are sort of one-off missions that are only going to be government funded, those have one contract mechanism where they bring in the private sector, but it's still a NASA project because the private sector is not making profit off of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas operations and vehicles that the commercial to make profit off of, whether they are trying to sell to other space businesses, other industries, that is a different contracting mechanism where they are NASA is essentially buying a service mm-hmm. from the private sector. So it's a different way of thinking. And yes, it absolutely can be done a lot cheaper, but it's all about the details and how we've seen even the commercial sector being delayed quite a bit with this launch that's coming up and others. So it's all, you know, we do see it playing out the way that we intend it to be, which is it is cheaper.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a calling in the industry to kind of change the way these contracts work. So there's, you know, there's the fixed price and the cost plus. So cost plus is, hey, here's this much money, but if you run into some problems or whatever, we'll give you extra money. And, you know, sometimes you can see these contractors running into problems and asking for extra money, whereas fixed prices, we want this for this price and we need you to bring this deliverable. And there's been a calling to kind of change that in this industry. And I think SpaceX is one of those businesses mm-hmm. that is saying, you know, we'll do the fixed price. You know, that's what we want to do.
But are there some safety considerations there? Because if they're saying we can do this for this price no matter what, I mean, space is tricky. We've heard that from pretty much anyone involved in it. So if you run into problems, are you running some risks by saying we're going to deliver this no matter what the cost?
And that's what NASA and other agencies kind of factor in when they're making these selections. So, for instance, there was a NASA selection of a spacecraft launch vehicle just a few months ago. And it's this very tight window that it has to get to these asteroids. It's like 21 days or something like that. And NASA went with Atlas V, citing, you know, its reliability because it has to be able to launch in this certain amount of time. It wasn't the cheapest option, but it was the most reliable option.
And SpaceX fought that, of course.
And SpaceX is fighting that now. But that just goes to show you that it's not the cheapest bidder or the lowest bidder. Mm-hmm. You know, you still have these concerns for safety and timing and all that stuff as well.
Right. And SpaceX, as you pointed out, they've sued NASA a couple of times to try and get on. And I wonder if other companies are thinking about that, too, if they're like, well, look, we want part of this too, and it's not fair to the way you're awarding these contracts. We've got a comment here coming in from Kokomo Kid, who writes, what's the point of putting humans in space? We've learned much more from robotic probes than we've ever learned from putting people in space and at a lower cost and risk. Laura, what do you think of that? I mean, should we just maybe stop at the mannequin, just let the mannequins do the work from here on out, or the robots?
Well, Ripley is proving herself to be a strong character, but as a scientist, I understand this point of view, but I also see it as a false choice. There's no reason why we shouldn't send both. In fact, both have their places. And on Earth, we see both happening as well. We have robotics that go into remote locations that humans can't or shouldn't go into, such as the depths of volcanoes, but we still send human explorers out into the world because humans have the intellect that robots can't have and arguably may never have. We have the creativity. We have the ability to react on an instant. The Apollo missions, they actually did way more science with the very limited Apollo exploration that the astronauts did than we would ever do with robotics and ever have done with robotics on another world. Mm-hmm. So even you can see the successful Mars missions, the Spirit and Curiosity and Opportunity, they are doing fantastic work up there. But the moment we send humans there, we're going to do much more than they could ever do. And so it's not a choice that needs to be made. There's definitely benefits to doing both.
And we heard this yesterday as well, that the space station is going to have, that we're going to ramp back up to having six folks on there. And once we have seven there, statistically, once the number raises to seven, we can almost double the kind of work that we're doing. So that's really important to the folks up there, too.
Chibeli, a lot of what SpaceX has done up until now has really pushed the limits of what's possible. And we talked a little bit about the fact that they can now reuse those boosters because they can land them again. And kind of watching the evolution of that has been fascinating. Sure. What kind of other challenges does this launch pose? And then down the track and some of the, strapping some astronauts into the Crew Dragon?
So this is the ultimate challenge, right? This is combining everything they've done up to now with human spaceflight. And, you know, can they do that safely? Can they dock safely? Can they bring that team back safely? And so that's something that they are watching very closely. That's sort of the purpose of this test flight, right? To make sure we're ironing everything out before we're sending crew. And I mean, there's still some concerns that are lingering. We know that the Russian Space Agency was very concerned there wasn't a backup computer system on the capsule in case it were to have a failure and potentially collide with the ISS. And they're worried about that because they have a cosmonaut on board. And so I think the teams have ironed that out. They've decided to put in some sort of fail safes. They're going to close a few hatches and have the astronauts climb into a Soyuz capsule in the case that there are several failures with the SpaceX capsule as it approaches. So they've built in some protections. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be the ultimate challenge for SpaceX. And they're very aware of that. They've been working toward this for many years. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that goes.
The number is 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Talking about the challenges of getting astronauts back up to the International Space Station on the SpaceX Crew Dragon, and of course down the track, Boeing Starliner as well, the two companies involved in the commercial crew program with funding from NASA. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Another question coming in on Twitter. If the SLS is rolled out in blocks or waves, what is the timeline for a full-scale SLS launch? This is back to what NASA is working on, the SLS, of course, the Space Launch System, their big heavy-lift rocket, even bigger than the Apollo rocket, I believe. Brendan, what's going on with that?
A lot of the hardware is being kind of stacked and put together as we speak now, and some of it's actually coming to the Kennedy Space Center. Kennedy Space Center has been busy working to upgrade the ground system to support SLS. But there have been a few delays. We're looking at the early 2020s now, I believe. Is it 2021, Chabelli?
I think it's a, yeah.
And that, from my sources, that's expected to slip just a little bit even more as well. But it's a big rocket. It's a new rocket. And they're, you know, the folks at Kennedy Space Center locally here are having to kind of refit everything to be ready to support it. So it's a big mission.
Yep.
And it doesn't help if they don't get the funding for it every year. So, you know, you're always looking at the congressional budget appropriations as well, and that could have some delays
as well.
That's
been a challenge for sure.
Mm-hmm. And it's a rocket that was originally, the concept for it was originally the Orion program, right? Getting back to the moon?
It was to lasso the asteroid and then put it in a lunar orbit was the plan. That has since changed, and now it's going to support lunar exploration missions and the Lunar Gateway, which is a space station that will be in a lunar orbit. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
What is it? What exactly is the Lunar Gateway?
Program.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, the Constellation Program.
Sorry, you were talking about the Constellation Program. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Laura. the Lunar Gateway is it's a space station. It's going to be smaller than the International Space Station that will live in this kind of wonky orbit around the moon. And it will be able to support science missions and also be a stepping stone for astronauts to land on the surface of the moon.
And be a stepping stone to Mars, too.
Mm-hmm. Laura, what about the funding piece of it? I mean, all the interest in this, and if this is successful, could it persuade some of the folks who hold the purse strings to give NASA some more money?
We haven't seen evidence that NASA is going to get any funding increase anytime soon significantly. NASA's budget has increased every year for the most part for the past several years. There has been news this morning that they're looking at cutting the budget about 5%, but that would be up to Congress, and Congress is going to raise their budget they do every year. So, no, I don't think that we're going to see a significant increase. It's all about where we allocate that money, where Congress and where the White House decides are the priorities to allocate that money.
Got a caller coming in now, Constantine. Constantine, I believe you work at the Space Center. Tell me about what's going through your mind thinking about this launch coming up.
We are excited about it, and we are hoping for success tonight with everything.
What kind of work do you do? Do you mind me asking?
No, our company tracks everything they launch from the Space Center.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be on tonight's launch also.
What do you think it means to have the prospect of astronauts once more, stepping into a spacecraft and blasting off from Florida? What does that mean to you?
Very, very good. It would bring back the shuttle days when lots of people came out to watch astronauts going to space. And like I've been hearing on your program there, Russia is the only one putting humans in space right now, so we will be back at it, and I'm thankful for SpaceX because they're really doing some things we never thought of.
Mm-hmm. Well, Constantine, enjoy watching that launch tonight, and thank you so much for weighing in. Chabelli, what about that? The idea of kind of tourism and public interest in these launches, is there going to be a spike in that, do you think, because there will be astronauts once more launching from Florida?
Yeah, we're expecting that to happen. I mean, you know, the eyes of the world are going to be back on the United States for astronaut launches. I think people have sort of forgotten. I mean, especially there was after the end of the shuttle program, there was this idea that the gates at KSC had been closed and nothing was going on anymore. And and so this is going to raise the profile a little bit. I think, you know, we're expecting there's going to be quite a few people here definitely this summer if the schedules hold for the crewed launches. And a lot of the local businesses are looking forward to this. There's one that Space Shirts that does. I spoke to them a few months ago. They do shirts for every single launch, and they're really ramping up, getting ready for this because they're expecting they're going to have a lot more clientele in the restaurants, and so yeah, I think we can expect at least some of the activity on the Space Coast that we saw during the shuttle.
And this is a big. I mean, within the agency, I mean, we know. The administrator, Jim Bridenstine, is here for this. The director of the Johnson Space Center is here. All of the astronauts that will be flying on SpaceX missions are here today. Like, so all eyes are really on tomorrow morning's launch.
Just based on the number of press conferences we've had to go to, we know this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Laura, I just want to come back to you for a moment. Last time we had you on the show, we were talking about something a little less pleasant, of course, the shutdown and the impact that was having on the space industry. Is that still kind of lurking in the background? I mean, everybody's pumped up and excited for this launch, but are you still kind of thinking, well, what happens if there's another shutdown and what impact is that going to have on commercial crew and all the other good things that are happening out on the space coast?
I think those fears have faded as our government has come together a little bit more for the budget. But what you do see are delays from the previous shutdowns, and they're still impacting programs. So several programs have been delayed several more months because of that one-month shutdown. And unfortunately, if the government shuts down again in the future, then you're going to see more delays. That's just the nature of the government programs and relying on the government funds, which is another reason why a lot of the private sector is trying to get more private sector money and venture capital involved so that they're not so reliant on the government funds.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura Forsyk is a space policy analyst with Astrolytical. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne. Brendan, thank you as well.
Always a pleasure.
And the Orlando Sentinel's Chibeli Herrera, who covers the space industry for the Sentinel. Chibeli, thank you for coming back as well.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Still to come on Intersection, poet Brian Turner takes a detour from poetry into jazz. We'll revisit an interview with Turner about the album he released last year with his group, the Interplanetary Acoustic Team. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit an interview recorded last summer with Orlando poet Brian Turner. Turner's collections Here Bullets and Phantom Noise and his memoir My Life as a Foreign Country draw on his experience in the US Army. Turner's newest project is a bit different, though. He assembled a group of musicians, the Interplanetary Acoustic Team. Turner and the Interplanetary Acoustic Team released an album last July called 1111 Me Smiling. The album includes lyrics from his late wife, the poet Elise Kuznets, who died in 2016. And here's a track from the Interplanetary Acoustic Team's new album. It's called The Tremble of Quantum Strings.
Can you hear me?
I spoke to Brian Turner, along with Ben Kramer, who performs bass, keyboards and theremin, and who engineered the album. Turner began by talking about his inspiration for the project, his wife, poet Elise Kuznets, who taught at Valencia College and was part of Orlando's literary scene.
We married and I moved here to Orlando, and then in 2016 she passed away from cancer. And her second book will be coming out next spring. But after she passed away, I remember I was flying across the country. I was about 30,000 feet up, and it was nighttime, and I was looking out the port window of the plane, and I was thinking about this one poem of hers called Before I'm Downloaded into a Most Excellent Robot Body. And it was this idea of cybernetics and the uploading of consciousness, which she knew wouldn't happen in her lifetime. And a conversation that we had for many years about robots and cybernetics and this type of thing fascinated both of us, and I realized that maybe this was an inroads toward a project where her voice could be shared with many. And that's really what became the genesis of this album.
And you have a lot of recordings of her reciting her poems and talking, and that's blended into this work as well, right?
Right. After she passed, that's what I ended up doing. I went through, it's part of the grieving process, is just trying to find and hold on to as much of your loved one as you can, you know. So I went through looking for photographs, but also audio. And she'd been a journalist in Scotland and here at the Sentinel at one point, too. So there were a lot of her texts, you know, journalistic dispatches and things, articles she'd written. But on background, she talked to these folks, a lot of famous authors, international authors around the world. And I have these little mini micro discs or micro cassettes that have her talking with them. And then also a lot of her readings that she did around the country. So those, along with some audio notes on her phone, create this audio archive that I sort of pulled from just on the specific subject of cybernetics and robots. And so this is just one little tiny slice of that larger conversation.
What do you play?
Nothing very well, but little bits and pieces of this and that. I started as a trumpet player when I was a boy in elementary school in Fresno, California. And then when I grew my hair long halfway down my back and switched to bass guitar and played some bass and some punk band by default because we didn't know very many chords.
Was that the name of the band, by default?
We should have been. We were called Los Muertos Muchachos, or the Dead Guys, you know, at the time. And it was a lot of fun playing in that band. And that band, we were a little bit like Spinal Tap. The drummer just kept blowing up or explode. You know, something would happen to the drummer. We just would change drummers and singers. And my best friend and I, that was really a love that we had, was making music and composing ideas and trying to sing.
So on this album, what instruments do we hear you on?
Bass, vocals, there's modular synth, which is a surprise to me, and because I was always very anti-synthesizer until this project, and also some acoustic guitar and electric guitar and a flugelhorn.
So Ben, tell me about how you came to be involved in the Interplanetary Acoustic team.
Brian and I first met actually through Jared Sylvia, who is a major contributor on this project. Jared and I worked together and introduced me to Brian originally. During the first project that we worked on together, which is not this one, but a previous album, I was just helping Brian bring his ideas to fruition. And soon we just started collaborating more and more. Sometimes as an audio engineer, you're just there to be the hired help and do the technical job. But with Brian, it just became more and more of a collaboration, and I have really enjoyed that part of the process.
Mm-hmm. And you play a bunch of instruments on this too. Tell me about some of the musical contributions you make on the album.
Sure. I play bass on a few of the tracks, and sometimes Brian and I are playing bass on the same track at the same time. So that's one example of something that's a little different on this album.
That's a lot of bass.
It's never enough.
Yeah. It's kind of metal.
There's a few keyboard parts that, I wouldn't call myself a keyboard player, but when the job needs to be done, I'll pull out the keyboard. And there's even theremin on one track, and I've never had a credit playing theremin on an album before, but this is it's a first for me.
Is this the first time you've played theremin, or is it something you're familiar with?
Oh, it is the first time I've ever played theremin. This is actually a theremin that me and my wife Serena built just for fun. And as we were creating the album, we thought it really fit on one of the tracks. So it was just the right thing at the right time.
And just to give our listeners an idea, I mean, theremin is something you might hear from like horror movie soundtracks from somewhere in the middle of the 20th century, right?
That's right. And then they had a little bit of a renaissance in the 60s when the Beach Boys started using it in some of their songs. And it's a nice addition to the album.
Right around the same time, Forbidden Planet came out just before that. And that movie had what's called a Krell patch. And that really, with synthesizers, that's sort of a signature moment in synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And Jared Sylvia got me into synthesizers. So the modular synthesizer, where you're, you know, creating take a signal and you amplify it and then split it and then shape the waveforms on each of those notes and then create a kind of, on the out, what comes out of the speaker is music, but it's really handcrafted from the very first signal of that music.
Mm-hmm.
So as he started helping me pull me down the rabbit hole of modular synthesis, I started finding about Forbidden Planet and the Krell patch, which is a sort of, it's hard to describe, but it's in a sense to me, it's a gesture towards immortality. It's a type of repetitive pattern that's random, that has randomness built into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that gesture towards the infinite seemed perfect for this album. And that's really what drove me towards modular synthesis. So I ended up getting what's called a No Coast, or it's by Make Noise, and then and working with a little kid synthesizers that have magnets and you put them together. They're called Little Bits by Korg. And that really taught me, just as it would with children, because I'm a child to the instrument,
mm-hmm.
and about some of the fundamental parts of synthesis and sequencing and envelope filters and et cetera, et cetera.
So you had a lot of fun with this.
Absolutely, yeah, because it's a learning process. And I think what it is, you know, I'd played some instruments before and composed songs with friends over the years. But I think sometimes when we have a certain practice, but if we disrupt it by adding a new factor into it, we can evolve and we have to respond to that. So it helps us find a new way into art, if that makes sense.
Do you take the same approach to music that you do to writing poetry?
In this particular case, all of the words are Elisa's words. So she had a different poetic practice. And so I had to sort of listen to what it was that the words were doing and what her intentions were as much as possible. And then Ben and I and Jared and the others, we had to try to find ways to create a sort of landscape of sound so that she could narrate the journey of the album.
Ben, I want to just come back to the theremin for a moment. How do you build a theremin? Are there plans out there?
You know, there's actually an active community of theremin enthusiasts out on the internet. If you're into something, there's usually a group of people on the internet that are also into that same thing. But this was actually a kit that my wife ordered because she was interested in it, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. So that was one of our weekends. We just decided to put together this theremin, and it really sat in the closet for a long time after we had our initial fun with it. And as you know, Brian, the process usually starts with ideas that come out of Brian's head, and one of them just called for a theremin. So I said, I happen to have one of those in the closet. It was just a moment of great collaboration.
Are you performing this album live anywhere?
We did once here in town. We tried it out. It's a little tricky because there's an opera singer who's in Cologne. The Parkington sisters are in Massachusetts. Sunil Yapu does some amazing guitar work on the album. He's in Montreal. So they're cast to the winds, you know, and how do we assemble the interplanetary acoustic team enough to do this? But Jared, Sylvia, and Ben worked together with some of the files to create like a skeleton of the song. And then we recently played, and Ben played bass, and I did some flugelhorn and sang and recited some of Elise's poems in it. We found variations of the songs that we could perform live. It was fun.
Now, this is coming out on the 13th, right?
That's the anniversary of Elise's birthday.
Brian, do you have any standout tracks off of this album?
We do. Light Sketch is one that features her voice, of course, but it also has an unusual thing where I contacted Elise's friends and best friends and her brothers, for example. I think there are about 12 people, and there's binary code that's sort of mentioned in the album. So I asked them to record ones and zeros. And then we sort of scattered their voices in the acoustic field. So there's this binary chorus of ones and zeros of people who love Elise that are in the background of that song.
How would you describe this music, Ben?
That's a great question. It's really an eclectic mix. It's unlike anything I've worked on before. Just like Brian was just saying, a typical session would include Brian coming and saying, here are a lot of audio recordings of people saying one and zero, let's make a binary chorus. So there's a lot of unusual elements, but at its core, it's synthesizer and electric elements mixed with analog instruments like performing bass live and keyboards, and then Elise's beautiful words.
And Brian, this isn't the end of this particular musical collaboration, right? You have some other plans.
I do, and most of that's just because I love working with Ben. You know, the main reason is just I feel like it's a really great collaboration, and he's able to sort of translate my thinking into, I feel like, oftentimes, and then his contributions, the way we work together, isn't the thing that I thought in my head, but it's better, you know, and I enjoy doing that. So, but to answer your question, yeah, there's a second album that I'm hoping will be sort of this idea of using a lot of her language in terms of living animals and creatures. She had a great love of nature, and I want to find a way to sort of translate that into following the narrative of this album. They'll be on distant planets and these sort of landing parties, finding odd and exotic animals and creating life and that kind of thing. And then the third album, which is already underway, is a kind of what I call a mixtape earth, and that'll just be a lot of funk and rock and some meditative songs, like those space people might have as a mixtape on their spaceship.
Yeah. Well, Brian Turner, poet and musician, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's brilliant. Thanks for having us here.
And Ben Kramer engineered and performed on the album as well. Ben, thank you too.
Thank you for having us.
And to take us out, a track from the Interplanetary Acoustic Team's album 1111, Me Smiling. This one's called The Stars. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Today's show was produced by Abe Abariah. Production assistance from Juan Gualda. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the Intersection podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. And you can listen back to archived episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.